Hello, and welcome to the check-in on KBIA. With everything else going on right now, it's time to go back to school. Students are arriving on our college campuses, and Columbia Public Schools is also returning to classrooms either in person or online September 8th. That means students, teachers, and parents are facing big decisions, and it's very hard to know where to turn. Without a national collective response telling us what to do in this pandemic, state and local community leaders, school officials, health directors are all figuring it out as they go. Whether you're a parent, a student, or a school superintendent, it might be easy to feel what former First Lady Michelle Obama called this week, left in the lurch. On the check-in today, we're talking with the people on the front lines figuring all this out. We'll get their views on how to navigate all these decisions and issues with going back to school. And later in the hour, we'll talk with the author of one of the most important books of the summer, Raven Leilani. That's next. Hi, this is The Check-In. School districts all over the state of Missouri have had terribly difficult decisions to make during this pandemic. How to manage classes online, whether to offer them in person, and what the impact of all this distanced and disrupted learning is having on our kids and our families. At the helm of figuring a lot of this out in Missouri is DESE, the state's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. Joining us to start this back-to-school conversation on The Check-In today is DESE's Communications Director Mallory McGowan. We're also going to hear this hour from Columbia Public Schools Superintendent Peter Stiepelman and Columbia Boone County Health Director Stephanie Browning. First, Mallory McGowan, welcome to the check-in.
Hi there. How are you guys today?
Hi, Mallory. Thanks. It's great to have you here. We're good. So let me say, first of all, DESE has been managing two really big task forces working on two big topics, distance learning and impact on students and coronavirus safety in schools. First, let me start by asking a general question, Mallory. What are you hearing from the teachers, parents, and advocates that you have on these task forces? Are there any key themes and takeaways?
Yeah, obviously this is an incredibly complex start to a school year, and the start of every school year comes with its own unique challenges and planning efforts, but this one obviously especially. Mm-hmm. I think some of the common themes that we're hearing is we know that there were a number of unintended consequences when school buildings had to be closed in March. Just to name a few, we watched the number of hotline calls regarding child abuse and neglect to the Department of Social Services. We watch those decrease. We know that broadband access and connectivity is a major issue in Missouri, a real digital divide. And our estimates show that about 1 in 5 Missouri students didn't have access to those online or virtual learning opportunities this spring. More consequences related to social emotional growth and development from our students. So just so many things that come with school buildings being closed. So one of the big themes we hear is just how important it is to, when it is safe to do so, mind you, bring our students back on site so that they can make sure some of those issues are addressed. And then on the other hand, there's just so many unknowns with COVID-19. How are we going to be really innovative and creative to make sure school leaders are supported in developing plans that allow for proactive strategies to address the health and safety of students and staff members, and then have the support they need to react to potential positive cases of COVID in their schools?
Okay, that's a really challenging list that you've put out there for us right now, Mallory, and we want to explore a lot of that. Let me just take a moment, though, to say that to our listeners, you're listening to The Check-In on KBIA, and we're talking about going back to school. We have with us Mallory McGowan from the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, DESE. That's where teachers, parents, school leaders have been working to create plans for school reopening, how to stay safe and sane with home learning and in-school learning. Mallory, you've seen a range of decisions across the state by school districts. Has anything emerged as best practices for districts navigating these times?
Well, Missouri being a local control state, we have decisions about important things like this made by those leaders closest to the decisions. I think what we're seeing is just a really continued collaboration between school leaders and local public health officials to use that local public health data to best dictate what decisions are made. So you've watched in metro areas across the state where school reopening has been delayed or has been announced that it will be completely virtual learning through the first quarter. And then we're watching other areas where public health data is indicating that a safe in-person on-site reopening could take place for many districts on Monday. So I think when it comes to best practices, the best practice we're seeing is that proactive communication between those leaders and making sure that they are ready with consistent standard, consistent protocols and standards to address these issues when they come up.
All right. Have you seen any innovations, any school districts out there or even communities, families kind of getting together and making things work and sharing resources in ways that strike you?
Well, you know, we saw a lot of that when school buildings were closed this spring. You know, one that comes to mind, an area of the state where there is a real broadband access issue. School districts were paying to print educational materials and lessons for students in their local newspaper so that students had access to something. We watched packets being delivered across the state. And so we saw innovation happening then. I think what the biggest piece of innovation and creativity that has happened since then is we know that educators did the very best they could to provide those learning opportunities for students this spring. But in a lot of cases, we knew that those plans needed to be flushed through, made more rigorous, fine-tuned, so that we had a better plan to pivot to if distance learning had to become the answer this fall. And so we've watched that happen across districts, choosing to utilize some kind of distance learning option, a virtual learning platform or program that will best meet the needs of their students.
Mallory, your list of challenges is actually really heartbreaking when you read these stories and you read about parents, two parents, working class, working outside the home, even with no other struggles, and many families have them, special needs. You know, some students are doing English as a second language. There are so many challenges that parents are juggling right now and doing a third shift. What can we do as a community, do you think, to lessen the disparities that are likely to happen with kids and families with these extra struggles? I should say actually probably typical struggles. It's probably rare to find the two parent over $100,000 income level that get to stay at home, and they are also really struggling. Anything that we can do as a community, do you think, to help lessen these disparities that are bound to happen?
Yeah, I think, you know, we are proud of the distance learning, remote learning supports and tools and resources that we stood up on our desi.mo.gov/COVID-19 webpage earlier this spring, just to provide people additional resources for that. I think what's important to know here is that equity and providing access to opportunities to every single student in our state, no matter their circumstance, is such a priority for our department, and it was before COVID. And so part of what I spoke about earlier, ensuring that the distance learning plans or plans that are set to be pivoted to should on-site learning not be a safe option any longer this fall, those plans are being reviewed and vetted here at the State Department, so that we can ensure that every child's needs are being met this fall if that plan has to be utilized. We know that there were a lot of struggles for families, whether it was related to the digital divide, students that have special needs or an IEP. We know a lot of those students had difficulty being served this spring, and we have to ensure that our schools are ready to come up with innovative ways to make that happen. You know, we're seeing some school districts that are choosing, you know, it's not always that you have to have all of your students on site or all learning at a distance. So there may be schools that are looking at having students with those kinds of special needs be on site, and the other students that may be able to learn at a distance more successfully, allow them to do that, and then you're having less students in the building if you just have those students that need some additional supports to be successful with their learning. So it's certainly a priority, and the reviewing of those plans is happening quickly and thoroughly here at the State Department.
Okay, that's Mallory McGowan joining us from DESE. Mallory, I know you're a parent. Good luck to you as you work with DESE and as you work with your family on the back-to-school issues. Thanks for coming into the check-in.
Thank you so much. Thanks for talking about this important issue today.
All right, take care. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back here on the check-in, we'll talk with Columbia Public Schools Superintendent Peter Stiepelman. We'll also bring in Columbia Boone County Health Director Stephanie Browning. We're going to talk about what the back-to-school plans look like from their perspective. That's right after this. Hi, welcome back to The Check-In. We're having a back-to-school conversation today, and a great person to help us sort through the many decisions parents and students are facing right now is Columbia Public Schools Superintendent Peter Stiepelman. Superintendent Stiepelman has been working with the Boone County Health Department and others since this pandemic hit, coordinating the pandemic response in our schools and for our school kids and families. He also happens to be a parent. Superintendent Stiepelman, welcome back to The Check-In.
Thank you, Jenna. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a general question for you, because there's so much to explore here. But as we wait to see how the MU campus reopening impacts our community, so school openings pushed back just a little bit to September 8th now, and as parents are grappling with their choices, which I think they've made by now, of in-person, online, or hybrid learning, that's kind of where we are. Generally, what do you think parents should keep in mind as they navigate all of this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, on June 22nd, we published our return to school plan, and as you mentioned, I mean, in that plan, we gave two choices. You could be all online, or you could be 5 days full day in person, and 80% of our community chose in person. And at that time, like, that decision of offering those two choices were made in consulting with our public health leaders, and I'm glad you'll have Director Browning on your show in a little bit. But local and state experts, teachers, leaders, community members, I mean, we were all working together. And the decision we reached was really because of those low number of positive cases in our community. But on August 4th, I made a presentation, and we invited our health department director as well as the chief medical officer. And that really showed March, April, May, June, that all looked perfectly fine for a full return to school. And then things have changed, obviously, as everyone has realized here in July and then certainly through August. I think yesterday we had 59 cases, and the Saturday before 50, and the Saturday before that 53. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to see locally some real case rates that are increasing. And so yesterday we actually released our updated plan. So I would really encourage anyone who would like to see our updated plan that includes all the information about our in-person hybrid model, as well as instructional plans for elementary, middle school, and high school, as well as our learning mode matrix, which is a tool that we're using to be able to identify and anchors us in a clear decision-making model that says, okay, so if you're between 0 and 10, this is what it'll look like. If it's between 10 and 50, this is what it looks like. And above 50, this is what it looks like. And so we are in a, you know, there are no good decisions, as you might expect, Janet, as I was listening to the representative from DESE talk. But I do feel really good about the amount of work that's gone into writing lesson plans, making sure we have a really clear written curriculum that is distinct from the spring, where we were all rallying just to try to make it through the rest of the year. But now we'll have, obviously, real lessons in terms of real time, real grades, real expectation for assignments to be submitted. And so it'll be a markedly different experience for families.
Okay, let me just take a moment to say this is the check-in. I'm Janet Saidi. We're talking with Columbia Schools Superintendent Peter Stiepelman about going back to school in Columbia, what that looks like right now. Yes, so Mallory with DESE did start out with this huge list of challenges facing parents. I know, Peter, this has been on your mind from the time that the pandemic hit, and it must be very difficult to sleep at night. Let me talk a little bit more about the logistics of what in-school looks like with your new plan. I know that the in-person classrooms are going to look really different. The kids will largely stay in their homeroom while teachers and counselors and even school lunches sort of are brought to them. Is that still the case with the new plan? And you know, you mentioned the, let me just make this a double-barreled question if you don't mind, because I think you can handle it. But you just mentioned the number of cases in Columbia Boone County, too. I guess you're prepared to change as we go. And so do you feel like this plan for in-person classrooms is going to last very long?
So that's certainly our hope. And so when we asked the board for the for permission to add an additional model, which was the in-person hybrid, and we'll notify families on Monday the 24th, so that's this Monday coming up, looking at our data, where we stand. The data tool that we're using is on our website as well, so anyone can observe it. In fact, when we released it, about 7,000 people started. We got a lot of hits, so we know a lot of people are looking at it. And so in our plan as well, we have a day in the life of what it looks like in terms of a day for students. We have some nice infographics to sort of help visualize for families and for teachers and for even for students to understand what the day might look like for them. And so we are ready if we had to pivot. My colleagues in the St. Louis and Kansas City area, these are the school districts, other large districts like ours that we are in constant contact with. And they have already moved to a fully online model. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we were to find ourselves in an all online. But we're trying to do our very best not to start the year there. And one of the reasons why is because we really need to see our kids. And so having them for 2 days a week is not ideal. Clearly, I'm a parent, as you mentioned, and so the thought in trying to figure out childcare and things like that is a real challenge for families. It's a real challenge for our teachers, who are parents themselves. And so when they learn that their children, you know, won't be in school for 3 days and will be doing their learning online when they're not in school, that presents a challenge. So we're working through and trying to figure out if, as an employer, we can try to find a way to take care of our families who don't have reliable child care for our employees. And so we're working on that. I think we're ready. It is, but it is an incredibly stressful time. So you're right. If you'd like to join my 3 a.m. texting group, I can.
You know. No, thanks. I'll catch you.
It's fairly incoherent. So.
You mentioned this. You know, the struggling families, which are really probably much more the typical family. The two parents that are essential workers working outside the home. Some many of them are teachers. And then if you have a special needs child, you have a English as a second language learner, so many challenges. I'm just going to ask you the same question I asked Mallory. What do you feel like as a community we can do about this? And do you feel kind of like the village that it takes to raise a child is coming through during this time?
I do. And I would say that if Columbia can't do it, then I don't know who can, because I have been so impressed with our health department. I've been so impressed with the United Way. I've been impressed with the Veterans United Foundation. I've been impressed with the Columbia Foundation, the Columbia Public Schools Foundation. I mean, when we asked for money this summer to be able to make sure that we continue to feed children, they all stepped up without even questioning it to make sure that we were transporting food to 80 different bus stops all throughout the summer to make sure that we were feeding kids. And that generosity and that commitment to our kids hasn't stopped. And so right now, while I was saying that we're trying to figure out how to take care of child care needs for our employees, these same groups that they are called Como Helps, and that group has come together really carefully and deliberately to try to see how could groups like Boys and Girls Club, or how could groups like Moving Ahead program through the Housing Authority, how can different groups, how can faith-based groups like the For Columbia group that has been so engaged with wanting to help out, how can they sort of support families that are trying to create pods, something that you see in certainly parts of our community have already been establishing sort of these same stable group to do their online learning. Well, how do we make sure that it isn't dependent on your affluence that you get to participate in something like that? And so there's a lot of coming together and a lot of dialogue. And so I'm super impressed with when you say the village. This is a village. This really is.
Okay, that's great to hear. And I have to say, I guess I'm pessimistic, but I really didn't expect you to say that. I thought you were going to say that you do feel kind of left in the lurch. But
yeah. No.
But we would all be worried if you
here, did. Now, when I talk to superintendents around the state, they don't have the same, they're not describing the same experience. So
okay.
There's just something really special about Columbia that has just constantly been it just buoys my ability to be able to say to you, no, I feel pretty good about our return.
Okay, well, let's bring another voice, really important one, into this discussion. We have Director Stephanie Browning with the Boone County Health Director. Director Browning has led the efforts on response since the pandemic hit and has been working on school reopening plans. Welcome back to the check-in, Director Browning.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
It's nice to have you here. And so both of you, Stephanie and Peter, have been working together to anticipate a couple of numbers that are on your mind. You're going to be watching positive cases and protocols. A big thing we're watching right now is MU, return to school, and how that goes.
Yeah.
Let me just ask, Director Browning, maybe you can let us know, if and when a positive case or exposure is reported in a school, what's the process that kicks in?
Sure. Well, I mean, like anything, we do very thorough case investigation, contact tracing. So if we have somebody that's like a student, let's like use an elementary school as an example. We have a student that tests positive. Generally, here's what has happened to date. The student tests positive, parent gets the result. Initially, the very first thing the parent's going to do is probably call the school. Right, we won't even have had the lab report in our hand, so the school's probably going to know about it before us, and so we set up relationships with every school, not only in Columbia Public District but also all of Boone County, and we have relationships with the private schools, and odds are they will be reaching out to us to let us know, hey, we've got a positive. We're going to work with them in advance to make sure that while we're waiting for the confirmation with the lab result, which would probably come around the next day, that they start pulling together their seating charts, their, you know, all of those things, and so that they can be prepared to work with us to help identify who may be the close contacts. When we interview the case, or in the case of a young child, it'd be the parent, right? You know, we'll not only be getting the close contacts that are in, like that they know of in the school setting, but maybe they have extracurriculars, or they've been to see the grandparents and who's in the family. So we'll be identifying all of those people and identifying who the close contacts are that need to go into quarantine.
Okay, and another number that you will both be watching is the less than 75% attendance. And you'll be watching, of course, the number of cases in Boone County. What is the number of cases in Boone County that would trigger pivoting to an online learning for CPS?
So for CPS, it would be looking at that rolling 14-day count. Mm-hmm. And so once we are over 50, then that puts us into a more restrictive environment in terms of an online platform. If, in fact, we find ourselves doing remarkably better, for which I look forward to that day, it will take us a couple of cycles before we agree to become less restrictive, because we just want to build that trend data to say, okay, things are better.
Okay. So another big thing on people's mind is what we have going on in Columbia is all of the students returning to campus. When it comes to this pandemic and education, we had University of North Carolina closed down after a week of classes. Stephanie Browning, what are your concerns when you look at the UNC situation and other college campuses? I mean, I feel like a lot of my colleagues, friends, and families are kind of looking around and shaking their head and going, should we really be doing this at all right now? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I understand that concern. I, you know, as a person that watches the numbers every day, as a person who's been here since the students left and has watched them come back, and as a department that's had to deal with the complaints about parties in East Campus and no masks and all of that, you know, it's concerning. And, you know, I mean, our numbers have definitely begun to creep up. You know, as Peter mentioned, we had our second tied for our highest day yesterday in tests that came back positive. When I left work last night, we had 1,700 cumulative cases. And when I came in this morning at our 9 o'clock ops meeting, we were at 1,747. Mm-hmm. So that was just overnight. So I expect today will be another big day. You know, again, the majority of our cases continue to be under the age of 30, with the highest number in the 20 to 24-year-old age group. And you know, we were young once, right? I remember the college experience, socializing, and I mean, we felt probably pretty invincible. And I guess the thing that concerns me is that if young people want to carry on as young people will do, their college experience may change dramatically. That would be my concern. And that changes this community as well.
Well, I mean, in looking at those numbers, let me ask you a general question while we have you, Director Browning. What is your focus right now? Do you feel like the community should be considering backtracking a little bit, locking things down more? Or do you feel like with hospitalization somewhat steady, deaths relatively low, but each one, of course, is tragic. What are your thoughts on where we go from here, given our numbers right now?
Right. Well, I tell you what, the hardest thing is, you know, if you think about the various orders and about backtracking and like slowing things down, the hardest thing to slow down is we're not seeing like an outbreak because people ate at a restaurant. Or, I mean, you know, we'll see people that someone might have gone to a local bar or worked in one. But what we're seeing is our cases are just people hanging, you know, young people hanging with their friends, whether it be at someone's house, you know, and that's hard to say, okay, we're going to, that's a hard one to control, right? It's a behavior thing. So, yes, our cases are pretty low, and we will continue to watch and see if there are any strategic things as we see new cases that we can do to tweak, but it's a challenge.
Yeah. Peter, do you have anything to add to that? And then also, you know, as a parent, what kinds of decisions have you made for your family? And what are you personally concerned about or glad about when it comes to the return to school?
Yeah, you know, the only thing I would add is it's tangentially linked, and that's just to be able to explain for those in our community who, you know, I get a lot of advocacy emails, right, about a full return to school. 80% of our community asked for that. I, as a parent, would like that too. And in some way, we've been there's been an indication that we, in some way, have like surrendered to fear. And I really want to speak so strongly that we have not. The CDC, they had a couple of bullet points that I thought were pretty impressive, or just to think about as a community. One, the parents and staff are absolutely concerned about the safety at school, and so we have worked really closely with our teachers and our principals about that. Is the music coming on to tell me that I should stop talking?
Our music is coming on. I would say just about 10 seconds, Peter, and wrap it up for us.
Well, I guess I would say the other thing to consider is just the harm that's attributed to closing schools entirely, and looking at the inequities that exist. And you mentioned children with disabilities, so we are looking at how we can provide some 5-day services for children with those are children who are exceptional. You asked me about my family. I have 3 boys. 2 are going in person, and 1 has asked to be online. So I'm going to experience it from both levels.
Okay, that sounds appropriate. Sorry about our aggressive music, Peter, but thanks for wrapping that up for us. Thanks to both of you for all you do and for coming on the check-in. We'll keep in touch with you. Stephanie Browning and Peter Stiepelman, take care, and thanks for checking in with us.
Take care, Janet. Please have us back. Thanks.
Okay, will do. Thanks. All right, we're going to take a quick break again. That was Superintendent Peter Stiepelman, Director Stephanie Browning. They are leading our village forward as we go back to school. We're going to take a quick break. Now, when we come back, we're talking with author Raven Leilani. Her new novel is getting loads of attention. It's featured in The New Yorker, The New York Times. It's rocking the literary world. And she's checking in with us here right after this. This is The Check-In. I'm Janet Saidi. Thanks for checking in with us today. One of the most talked about books of the summer is Raven Leilani's debut novel, Luster. And it has a Missouri connection, at least for today, because Ms. Leilani will be in conversation with Skylark Books Bookshop in an event tonight. And she's agreed to check in with us to talk about the story told in her novel, Luster. It's the story of Edie narrating the honest, surprising journey of a young woman navigating all the things. Work, life, sex, and most importantly, art. And it's also about much more than that, which we will explore right now with Raven Leilani. Welcome to The Check-In, Raven.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, because I just have to say, this isn't always the case. I know you've done a lot of interviews, but I'm lucky in that all of us, and you know, that are in journalism and public radio, that sometimes you get to interview novelists that we've read, but this happened super quickly. I literally finished your book, put it on the kitchen table, and then saw that you were at Skylark, and was
incredible.
Really, really excited that you were able to come on right now. So usually it's sort of years after I've read someone that, but I feel like I just met you through your book, and now you're on the check-in. So welcome. So, you know, and the book is getting a lot of attention. I think I heard about it somewhere, picked it up, and then it arrived, you know, write-ups about it arrived in my New Yorker this issue. I think my Sunday Times this week also had it in there. Let me ask how all of this attention, because it's your first novel, how is it changing your life right now?
It has completely changed my life. I will say, you know, maybe about a month ago when we were about to head into this, I got a really beautiful letter from a writer I hadn't met before. And he said, "You may know this already, but your life is about to change."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I read that letter and I was like, is that true?
Yeah.
And a week later, it kind of started to dawn on me. You know, you mentioned finding me in The New Yorker, and it was absolutely wild to kind of open my issue, because, you know, I get them, you know, they just come in and I put them on my coffee table, and and this one came in. It was absolutely surreal to open it and see my book, and it has been the reception too has been incredibly warming, especially in this moment, you know, when there's so much going on. I think that I used to work in publishing, so I have very managed expectations around what it would be to publish
yes.
a book, especially publishing in a climate like this. And so I'm just really thankful that people are, you know, they care about the book, that it's connecting with people. It's really a dream.
Well, that is really great to hear, because I know that, you know, if I got my New Yorker and suddenly found myself in it, I think I would find that terrifying. So, but like you said, you've navigated this stuff. You've worked in publishing. You knew, even though it was your first novel, and you're not an old person, but you knew what you were getting into. So that is really
right.
great to hear, and really exciting. And I know also that you have slightly changed your name, which I think must really help, and I think is really advisable for authors
yeah.
out there. So let me talk about Luster. So it's a really, you know, it's been called all these things, and it's really tempting. I review books sometimes. It's really tempting to bring up all the cliches, but it is a really intimate first person narrative of a young woman, Edie, who's navigating sexual politics, racial politics in the workplace and in relationships. But it is about so much more, which we would love to explore. But let me just first ask you, what drew you to create Edie's story?
So I'm in love with art. It was the very mm-hmm. first thing I ever loved. That was where I started. I started with painting before I kind of put it aside and started writing more seriously. And so art creeps into pretty much everything I write. In the short fiction I wrote before this, the art was there. And this book was really my opportunity to have the page space to tell, you know, a bigger and more complex story about what it is to try and lay claim to that art, especially if you're, you know, a young Black woman.
Yes. And so Edie is a young Black woman, as you say, who's painting. You are a young Black woman who's also painting, but you are also, you know, you really do seem to approach your writing like a painter. Your sentences are really astonishingly original, I feel like. And it's funny because I would say they are keenly observed, which is a cliche that reviewers used. But I feel like after reading Luster, you should just use keenly observed and then retire that phrase forever, because it is incredibly keenly observed. It's almost like you've taken a scene, an image, a person, and you kind of dismantle it and then put it back together, sort of the way a painter might do with portraits. But I know nothing about painting, but it seems like you do that with sentences. Let me just ask, since you brought up art and sentences, how do you craft your sentences? What goes into that?
I really appreciate you saying that. And I think there's an element of art making, at least in with painting, any sort of visual medium, that requires a close degree of observation. And so I think because I was coming from that practice, that found its way onto the page. But also I will say, language is really, really important to me. You know, the books that I gravitate to, they have an energy to them, like an electricity on the sentence level. And the very first writing I fell in love with is poetry, which I think is very, very focused on the language, very disciplined in its intent in the use of language. And I also too, like when I'm writing, I need to feel like it's fun.
Yes.
You know, the sign of a project that is maybe not the right project is it feels like drudgery. And if it feels like drudgery to you, then it absolutely does to the reader, right? And so I really wanted to create an experience where perhaps even in the language, a reader might feel that joy. You know, that was really important to me.
So it's interesting, as you're writing about Edie, who, you know, we're talking about her as a painter, we're kind of getting straight to her story. But at first, her story seems to be about a young woman working in publishing who's basically having a lot of sex. And if you read a lot of the write-ups about Luster, that is kind of what's front and center. But I feel like your novel kind of goes through a metamorphosis that Edie herself goes through. She is a young woman working in publishing, having a lot of sex, but she becomes a really strong artist, if it's okay for me to kind of land a spoiler there. But that is kind of what happens. The centering in your story changes from being kind of what like guys might like reading about to kind of being turned inside out and being about a young Black woman finding herself, and really two young Black women in this world emerge as the important characters with a capital C. Did you kind of intend to trick us into this kind of cool metamorphosis? Or did that just kind of happen naturally by you exploring and writing what you wanted to write about?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of, I never really know what a project is. I have to write to find it out. Writing for me is discovery. But I also, yes, on a craft level, you know, I wanted the book to have those two halves, you know, the half that is about, and I don't know if half is like the right word, you know, quadrant, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted the book to have a, you know, the component that talks about art, that talks about the messiness of that trajectory when you were trying to pursue it, and what that looks like when the work is private and you yourself have to kind of affirm your artistry and feel that private work is real. That the, you know, the sex too is a part of the human story I wanted to tell in this book. You know, a story about a woman who's seeking intimacy and seeking connection, and is very situated in her body. You know, there's so much drama, you know, about the body, and it would have felt like an omission, right, to leave out that drama, that part of living that is bodily. And Edie as a character is one that is deeply wanton. You know, I wanted to make room for that yearning and for that desire, which I think, you know, you also see in her art.
Yes, you do. And speaking of her yearning and desire, I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are about feminism as a writer. Edie makes some, you know, in her yearning, she makes some distinctly some choices that we would consider distinctly unfeminist. But totally. There's something very feminist about centering her journey and all of its contradictions and all of its needs, you know, which is very realistic. Is this something you think about, or do you simply just write experience as honestly as you can?
So I guess I should be 100% honest and say that in those scenes specifically, in general, I feel like I cannot think about sort of the reception or like even really truly the political implications of what I'm writing until it's done. You know, I have to feel a freedom to come to the page, but There are definitely moments during those sections where I felt, oh no, is this unfeminist, right? Like that was a real preoccupation I had and a real responsibility I felt in depicting Edie's sexual agency. But ultimately, the way it kind of came out was, this is a woman who is asserting what she wants, and I want to allow her room to assert that agency. You know, for me, feminism is making room and keeping an open mind for what desire looks like for women, you know, and so, like you said, contradiction is the word, right?
Yes.
A human portrait holds all of those contradictions, and it was important for me to make room for that.
I think that's a whole conversation that really needs to be explored in our culture, and it takes a lot of courage to do it, and you're very much leading the way on that conversation, which is, you know, the contradictions of female desire and it can fit right into feminism, but it doesn't always feel like it. So I'm very glad to know, though, Raven, that you're not, when you're writing those sex scenes, you're not thinking about Betty Friedan or Shirley Chisholm or anyone else. Let me just say really quickly that you're checking into the check-in with us today. We are talking with author Raven Leilani. Her book, Luster, tells the story of a young woman navigating her way through all the things in the world, but also finding herself. And it's about much more than that, and we're exploring what we can. So another theme that you explore is that I think would be easily missed, Raven, is one that I think is one in a lot of great literature, which from Jane Austen, the Brontes, you've actually been compared in The New Yorker to Tolstoy and Anna Karenina. Edie emerges as someone who's, you know, searching for a home and then finds a home, and how sort of shelter influences her as an artist and allows her to make her art. Are you attracted as an artist also to this theme of seeking and needing shelter?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really, truly deeply relevant, I think, in general to the art making process, to having the means, to having an environment which sort of facilitates that, you know, creation. You know, mm-hmm. with Edie specifically, the impediments that are there that kind of preclude her ability to make art, they do have to do with like those fundamental survival questions. Can she pay rent? You know, can she pay her student loans? And does she have a place to live? Which I don't know. Perhaps this is a spoiler, right? But like that, the movement of the book it happens that way in part because she does lose her where she lives.
Yeah.
And when she does find shelter again, even though that shelter comes with its own complications,
yes,
suddenly, right, she can generate. And so I did want to talk about those survival questions as they relate to art. And I felt a real personal connection with that. Because for me, and I think for a lot of people who are making anything, it is a real challenge to juggle work and art, you know, the thing that allows you to live and eat, but that also perhaps kind of takes up the bandwidth that you would otherwise need to create.
No, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, so yeah, I mean, that was a really important aspect of the book for me, which was her seeking out that shelter, which ultimately, becomes an environment in which she, not without complication, can create.
Yeah, that's great. And sorry to interrupt there, but I was getting excited because I was just thinking that, you know, you're kind of dramatizing this and making it literary, this struggle, this vulnerability that a lot of people are facing, especially right now. And, you know, I assume, Raven, that you wrote this story, Luster, pre-pandemic. and before the racial justice movements arose, before people were so as vulnerable, and these disparities actually in our culture and the vulnerability of people, and many of them artists, were so apparent to us. How do you think the pandemic and also awareness of racism are influencing how this story is being received and landing with people right now?
Well, you know, I have noticed that, like, you know, I'm starting to do interviews, and like when you write a book, you cannot anticipate or predict the climate you'll release it into. And as far as you know, the sort of reckoning we've had around racism and police brutality, those are old and familiar and ongoing problems. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote this book, I didn't know that I would be releasing it during a time when those, you know, it would kind of beg those questions, you know, in this way. But I wrote the book as a Black person who has moved through the world in a body that, you know, with a hyper awareness that I am in a body that is imperiled, you know, mm-hmm. and that made its way almost naturally onto the page. And so there's an element of it where it just is an extension of my experience. And I needed in this story that is about art and about longing to make room for that part, because Edie is a character, you know, she is a Black woman. Her race is and gender are relevant to the trajectory of pretty much all of her pursuits. But I would say, you know, as a writer, you hope that when you release a book like this that does touch on these issues, you do not hope that it will be as relevant, you know?
Yes.
It would be a wonderful thing if I could point to those sections in the book and those were distant. That was history.
Yes.
I would like to, you know, I think we all would like to move to a place where we're not so, you know, we're not necessarily reflecting what is actually happening right now and kind of all the time.
Absolutely. That makes sense. You did not want to be this on point exactly, you know, as you were writing it. But it you know, at least it is probably helping to foster a conversation that's going on and a hunger that people have to understand. You have a scene of police brutality in this story. I've not noticed anyone else bringing this up except for, I think, one reviewer who said, oh, it would have been good if this scene weren't in it. It wasn't necessary. Right. And I was just a little astonished at that. But to me, the scene juxtaposes the security and even malaise of this quiet suburban home that Edie finds herself in with another young Black girl who's been adopted by this family. Or at least a foster child with the families. And so you have two young Black women in this suburban home, and it's juxtaposing that sort of quiet and the security that's feeding both of them, but also with the struggles and tragedies that are genuinely experienced by these two characters, Edie and the younger woman. And what are you hoping that readers see and experience through Edie in that juxtaposition?
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's interesting. I think you move a character to the suburbs. You know, the book is, you could almost call it in two halves. One part is in, you know, the city in New York City, and second part is in a Jersey suburb. And the moment that Edie arrives, you know, she feels the surveillance.
Yes.
And Akilah, you know, all but confirms that this is something she is aware of as well. And I wanted to talk about that, how quickly that surveillance becomes violent. You know, we've seen the clips circulating, and I just wanted to talk about that. What that means, what that setting means, what those central problems are for a character who is Black.
Raven Leilani, thank you so much. You can hear our music telling us that it's time to wrap up, but I've enjoyed the conversation and wish you all the best. I wish you and your family health and happiness as you get through this pandemic. And
we'll
see you tonight at Skylark online.
Yes, thank you for having me.
All right, take care. That was Raven Leilani. She's the author of Luster. You can join her in an online book reading with Columbia's Skylark Bookshop tonight at 7. Go to skylarkbookshop.com to register for that. That's it for the check-in this week. I'm Janet Saidi. We will see you next Thursday, same time, same place. Until then, stay well and stay in touch.